Welcome back to the Lyme Podcast. My name is Aaron Alexander. This is a place that we bring together the world's leading experts in all things health and wellness to help you optimize your mind, body, and movement. Today's conversation is with my friend, Jeff Krasno. Jeff is the founder of Wonderlust Festival, which has featured some of the world's most iconic thinkers, including Deepak Chopra, Marianne Williamson, Russell Brand, Matthew McConaughey, people of the sort. He was featured as Oprah's Super Soul 100 Nation's Leading Entrepreneurs. He is a really brilliant human being. Very grateful to get to share some time with him today with y'all. This conversation is all about communication. It's all about connection, and particularly how we can regulate our own physiology to be better communicators. I think this conversation is very valuable. I think you guys are going to enjoy it, and I appreciate you subscribing. Appreciate you sharing this episode. Appreciate your comments wherever you're listening to this, and appreciate you doing you. Let's get to the conversation with the great Jeff Krasno.
We're out here.
Okay.
Just alleviating stress via respiration. So I've gone through the good stress manual. I want to talk about ways that we can start to come into right relation with stress, the concept of good stress versus bad stress. I just want to start with what is stress? How do we define stress in the first place?
Yeah, so stress is an experience in the body, and it can have various degrees of salience and various degrees of valence, right? So it can be chronic. It can be distress, which is generally what we experience in modern life. So as a product of our lifestyle, of culture, we can be kind of overworked under a tremendous amount of pressure, kind of subject to a lot of hyperbole and sensationalism and fear. And that can push us into this experience in the body that is chronic distress or bad stress. And we know it when we feel it, but there are also objective metrics to it. So, you know, you can measure it, you know, most simply kind of with cortisol, but testing, but in a whole variety of ways, because the downstream impacts of this distress or chronic bad stress are kind of multifarious. So anything from kind of gut dysbiosis to elevated glucose levels to kind of depressed immune system. So that's bad stress, if you will. But stress, you know, can also be experienced in short, acute bursts. And evolutionarily, that is more or less how we did experience it. And so these acute bursts of stress, whether they're physiological or psychological, the body is actually naturally engineered to bounce back, if you will, from that experience. And we know that just by sprinting up a hill, you know, our respiratory and our heart rate will zip up and spike. And then the body brings us back to homeostasis, equilibrium, balance, alignment, if you will. And that is good stress, because it turns out that the body experiences what is known as hormesis, so a beneficial impact physiologically and psychologically to stress when it's experienced in acute and short bursts. You can sort of now, unfortunately, in the modern age, most of the stress that we experience in our body is chronic and bad. And that sets up a whole panoply of evolutionary mismatches, which we can unpack. But in this kind of era of endless convenience and comfort and convenience and ease, we have to now sort of self-impose acute stress in order to align with our inherent biology and reap some of those benefits. And this is what I'm trying to kind of unpack, both psychologically, physiologically, also how does stress, good stress, apply to social situations, for example? Because, you know, we experience a lot of social stress now too, but we experience it very, very differently than from our Paleolithic ancestors. So that's kind of how I think of this dichotomy between bad and good
stress. What does that mean, social stress?
So, like, for example, right now in culture, so much of our communication has now become sort of digital, right? So there's all of this kind of anonymous digital warriorship sort of being waged anonymously behind screens. And it's not like conflict never existed before. Conflict is as old as the universe. In fact, conflict, again, can be positive and yield positive results. But evolutionarily, how did we used to deal with conflict? And I might just say that this might be a fun guide. We can use him or not, but I created this sort of avatar of myself, who I call Fedge, which is just sort of unimaginatively my name spelled backwards, but he's kind of my East African, great, great, great times 600 grandfather who, you know, lived on the Serengeti. And I oftentimes try to like put myself in his shoes, although he didn't generally wear any, but, and that's another point of conversation. But I was like, how did Fedge deal with conflict? Well, he largely dealt with it face to face, right? And in that way, you know, we were so obviously reliant on each other. Community is so adaptive that we actually had to work through our forms of conflict resolution face to face, such that we found common ground, cooperation, you know, common humanity. You know, we knew that we were invested in collective enterprise, et cetera. And we were just much better at it, I think, when we had that opportunity to consistently be face to face. And now I think, you know, we have to actually lean in to stressful conversations, actually engineer them into our life instead of just kind of straw manning ad hominem, you know, barbs of vitriol, you know, sent over the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. Stressful conversations. It seems like part of that is a lot of the conversations that I experience is just like two monologues, you know, and the person's already. Yeah. It's just two people trying to prove their point and be confirmed to be correct, and not really even having much empathy or compassion for the person on the other side. So I wonder, how does a person start to bridge greater relation or integration with a person, that it's not just two monologues, but actually can turn into connection and conversation?
Yeah, well, I think there's sort of an on-ramp there. I mean, first of all, you need yourself to be in a parasympathetic place. So you need to feel safe and secure. And that honestly requires some degree of training, in this day and age. So, you know, we might be the recipient of some like insult, you know, on social media or in an email or et cetera. And our first, you know, reaction to that may be one of bad stress, of essentially dysregulation.
Yeah, like reaction.
Reaction, totally. And that can put us into a place of kind of amygdala hijack, such that, you know, then we're angry. Someone has essentially transferred their own anger to you. You've picked it up in the form of like an ember. And then you are just brooding over your rejoinder, waiting to throw that ember back. Of course, all that time, right? You're the one getting burnt, right? So, the Stoics had this concept of euthymia. So euthymia is sort of like an unflappable state of like emotional equilibrium. And, you know, for them, like the best way to disarm an insult was just to be unaffected by it. right? So, you know, I'm would certainly not make a case to excuse like odious behavior and neglect and abuse and racism, et cetera. At the same time, one can take some of our own personal responsibility to building what I call the psychological immune system. Mm. So, you know, and I know your audience is very briefed on the kind of physiological immune system. So we know how we build that. So, right. So, you know, low grade exposure to viruses and bacteria and pathogens over time.
Sun the anus.
Sun the anus all day if you'd like to. I would just say maybe at higher latitudes if you have less melanin, but that's another thing.
Use zinc.
Yeah, use zinc.
In case you're at lower latitudes.
Yeah. But you know, we build our physiological immune system through some exposure to insult, right? So, you know, there's, you know, my wife grew up on like a hippie commune in Northern California. She ate a lot of dirt, basically. And she, if you go back, her parents still live on this funky ranch up there. And if you go back, you understand why she has such a strong immune system. Yeah. It's like there's like a crusty Paisley comforter that hasn't been changed in like,
yeah, she's probably, you know, not three allergic decades. To hardly anything.
No.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the same logic can be applied to your psychological immune system, right? So exposure to some degree of low grade pathogen, of low grade insult over time, you know, you can really inure yourself to it. You can really build some immunity, you know, to insult or to ad hominem. And I have basically put myself deliberately through that experience. So in 2020, I began to write this weekly musing for Commune, for my company. And, you know, 2020 offered us every polarizing issue under the sun, you know, from the pandemic to, you know, the national inventory on social justice and race and every crazy, far-fetched fantasy fever dream out of Trumplandia or whatever. So, you know, I was writing a weekly essay and I was sending it out to about 1 million people. And I would put my personal email address at the bottom of it. And so, you know, Monday morning, I'd open up my computer and like the bow of my inbox would be crested with, you know, responses. And many of them were like very kind and encouraging. And, you know, I took a lot of time to like write pretty highly researched, pretty rigorous, like Buddhist-y middle way kind of essays. And, you know, trying to take everyone's, you know, opinion into equal proportion and you know, find some sort of homeostasis if possible. But of course, over like 2,000 words, I was bound to piss somebody off, right? And I got probably 50 emails a week of people that were highly critical of something that I wrote. And some of them were just like, the responses were like, you know, Trump 2020, like copy and pasted a million times, you know, and like, there's nothing I could really do with that. But there was all over the political map. It wasn't just people on the right. It was like, you know, hardcore abolish the police people on the left being like, how dare a white man center himself in this conversation right now? You know, I'd just be like, I'm writing a weekly essay, you know? So, but my initial reaction was, I took it very personally and I was like, oh, stay up all night, like brooding over things and stuff like that. And then over time, you know, I just actually started to really look forward to the detractors. Hmm. And I was like, what are these people going to say? And the more sort of like thoughtful, intelligent ones I would respond to, and, you know, there would be sort of a volley of emails. And eventually, I would ask them to come on a Zoom call. And at that point, it was like a little bit of my David Copperfield routine. Most of them just like disappeared into thin air. But I did about 25, 26 conversations, hour-long Zoom conversations with people that essentially didn't like me. And that was in August and September 2020. I actually started to build it into my calendar, Monday and Tuesday afternoons. Jeff, you know, talks to someone who doesn't like him. It was like in my...
Was this recorded for other people, or was this like a private thing? You wanted to talk to him?
I just wanted to talk to him.
That's cool.
I don't think they would have agreed to recording them. I did suggest that a few times, and I was just kind of flatly denied because people just didn't want to have those conversations. I think it was sort of like at that juncture, I would have had a sort of more power in those conversations because I would have controlled the medium. So,
yeah, right.
So my first step was like developing this euthymia, some sort of like unflappable state of mind. And then the second was actually leaning in and scheduling these conversations. And, you know, I call it good stress. You know, it is actually leaning into stressful conversations.
Yeah.
And at first, like, I didn't have any grounding in nonviolent communication. All these other approaches and systems and techniques that I later discovered, but sort of had to instinctually walk backwards into during these Zoom calls. But they were fascinating how they actually unraveled. And I mean, I can tell you about it a little bit, but over time, you know, I developed actually skills in conducting stressful conversations.
I wonder, so I'm interested in what those skills would be. I'm also interested in how you've used these skills in communication and connection to build the companies that you have and the mailing list of a million plus. And I was initially introduced to you what's the festival called that I'm a big fan of?
I hope Wanderlust.
Wanderlust. Yeah. Sorry. I don't know why I spaced that. Yeah. Wanderlust is like one of my favorite festivals. It hasn't been, and now apparently it's continued to be a thing, I guess, but it hasn't been a thing for many years. I went out to the event with Russell Brand, and like, it was just a very, I taught some acro yoga stuff there at the time. It was just a really amazing way to do a conference or a festival, or kind of like a conflation of conference and festival. And so you've had the ability to live a life that seems from the outside looking in to be pretty incredible, you know, pretty creative and dynamic. And you've been able to connect with some of the most amazing minds on the planet, and then also be able to have outreach to, you know, million plus human beings. How is communication and interpersonal relationships, how have you built such a system? What are some like tips and tools or tactics or things that people could learn from that journey?
Yeah, well, I will say I was not very good at it when I started. And I'm not always proud of how I conducted myself at Wanderlust from a CEO perspective.
Yeah.
I wasn't the humble leader all the time. I thought I needed to be in every meeting and, you know, make every decision, et cetera. And over time, I just simply learned that is bad stress for me. But it's also, doesn't allow for growth and within a company, because people feel disempowered. So feeling is an actual massive component of it, especially if you're leading a team. So, you know, there are bound to be difficult conversations and conflicts within an enterprise. And, you know, one of the things that I learned very quickly from these conversations, but also just from the experience of being a leader, you know, in these enterprises, was really trying to understand how people feel. Instead of actually like, oh, you know, that logo fucking sucks, use this one, you know, or whatever. I was in a ton of those meetings, but is actually what is underneath that, you know, in the design department, you know, what are people's feelings that they have about a particular thing? And then how do you actually meet the needs of those feelings? And how do you then both articulate and demand clarity around how you meet the needs of those feelings? So this is right out of Marshall Rosenberg nonviolent communication techniques. And over time, you know, I got much better at it and I could model it. And then, you know, people would mirror that and reflect it back. I think the other piece that I really learned more as a result of these, you know, aforementioned, you know, conversations was, you know, when people, and then I've applied it virtually everywhere in my life. And this is the great thing. It's like, you can have these stressful conversations with people that, you know, you don't even know, but what you learn from it is so applicable to your life. Because if you can have someone that, you know, that thinks that you're Antifa or something like that, then you can you imagine like how useful those skills are in your own family, you know, or with, you know, your parents or, you know, your siblings, et cetera.
Yeah.
So one thing that I learned was like, I would get on these Zoom calls and it was the same pattern every time, Aaron. It was so funny. There would be sort of an exchange of pleasantries at the beginning. But then I would not say anything for generally 40, 45 minutes. People would just essentially fire hose me with their biography. And really not concentrating at all on the original issue that had put us at loggerheads. They would just tell me about their life. And what I realized is that I needed to create the set and setting that was safe and secure such that people could be heard and seen. Mm-hmm. And that was the best service I could provide. And then as they were like just telling me about their adolescence and all of their trauma, I would take notes, and generally about the most prosaic parts of their life, but where there were actually convergences with their life and mine. Mm-hmm. So perhaps they were born in Chicago, or they had daughters, or they drove cross country when they were a teenager, all things that I did. And I would start to write down those areas of consilience. And then finally, when they had exhausted themselves and stopped, I'd be like, oh my God, well, I have daughters too, and mine are a little bit older. So, you know, maybe I could give you a couple of tips on like getting your daughters to still give you a hug or whatever it would be. And what I realized subsequently is that in order to really foster these conversations that kind of stand between us and the world that we hope is possible, we really need to seek connection first and then seek agreement or solution. Hmm. It's really seeking connection, not solution. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, once I started to have that conversation of like, yeah, I was born in Chicago. Oh, what neighborhood were you born in? I was like, oh, well, my parents grew up in Evanston or whatever. You know, all of a sudden, there would be this common ground, this common humanity, this sense of connection that would transcend kind of like the petty grievance that we might have initially had. Yeah. And sometimes we would get around to whether or not the police should be abolished or not. And we would probably continue to disagree about that. But we found a place of connection. And it's funny, man, I built this whole sort of Rolodex of frenemies, you know, people that then we would text and I'd be like, look at this idiocy. Is this one of you guys? And then like, you know, it just became playful and fun. And I met a ton of Trumpers, honestly. Still, there's two of them that I text with all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a big Trump guy. So it's interesting to get, you know, a viewpoint into their world. And to understand why, you know, they can have a point of view that's so diametrically opposed to my own, but that I can still find some common humanity.
Yeah, there's a, I reshared a thing on the social media the other day about this 114-year-old gal, and they were asking her what she did to, you know, stay so youthful at 114. And her response, she probably said other stuff too, but at least in the meme, her response is love everybody.
Yeah.
And my addition to that in my own mind that I didn't end up sharing or whatever, it was just me in my own mind in my car. I was like, I think this is good. It's like, love everybody, especially those you hate, because those are the people that I think there's actually the greatest amount of like work and lesson within yourself, because there's probably some reflection back to yourself you know, there's some part of yourself that you don't accept or something that's like, it's a taller obstacle to get over, to be able to love the folks that you actually really truly have distaste for. And if you can do that, my feeling is eventually it translates to greater love within yourself. You know, so it could be a very selfish endeavor to actually extend and expend energy into truly opening up compassion for the most challenging, vitriolic people out there to you. If you're able to find compassion and love for those, my feeling is it spills back in towards yourself and you just end up having a greater level of ease and equipoise in relation to your thoughts and feelings and the way that you relate to the world. And eventually that translates to exposure therapy, to stressful factors in the world. You become harder to rock if you lead with compassion.
That's exactly right. You know, seven times down, eight times up, right? That's the Zen saying. You know, you become kind of a weeble wobble. You might be too young for weeble wobbles. They were around when I was a kid.
I'm familiar with the weeble wobble.
Yeah, you can't knock them over. They always find their center again eventually, right? So that's my goal. I want to become a weeble wobble. You know, there's this other technique, Aaron, that I started to play around with. I think I first saw it modeled in a debate between Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, and it's called steel manning. So it's sort of the opposite of straw manning.
Yeah,
it's like basically instead of, you know, listening to someone's point of view and forming a rebuttal the whole time in your head to counterpoint that argument, you actually listen to understand.
Yeah.
You don't listen to respond, you listen to understand. And then when you do respond, what you're doing is you're actually regurgitating or reiterating the best parts of your opponent's argument.
Yeah.
So, and it's an amazing technique because you really do have to, you know, put down your biases for a moment. But also it often fortifies your own position because you have to consider the best parts of someone else's position. And so, you know, and then of course there's the opportunity for some form of moderation in your own position there. So, you know, just can you imagine if we could model that such that they adopted this on Capitol Hill or something where it's like, you know, they're debating. I mean, they're not even debating really anymore in our public square. There's just no room for it. You know, everyone's just speaking over and screaming over each other and looking down their own nose at, you know, with moral indignation at the other side. And, you know, but there's so many issues that could benefit from it: abortion, immigration, et cetera. So, so these are very, I think, worthwhile techniques.
There's a quote I pulled up from Martin Luther King because I always say it wrong. And this is actually totally different than what I thought it was, but this is what I found. Said that you have very little morally persuasive power with people who can feel your underlying contempt. So if you're if you're having a conversation and you're not starting with connection, you're still coming from a contemptuous place where it's like, I'm going to get you. There will be no conversation. Yeah. You're just going to have two monologues and you're just going to have friction and fire and that's it. You're going to expend a bunch of energy. You're going to expend some ammunition on both sides. You're going to walk away both a little bit more like tattered and wounded. Maybe one person feels like they won. Maybe they both feel like they won, but there will be no progress.
Yeah.
And so if you can start from that core root place of actually alleviating yourself of contempt and opening yourself up to compassion for a person, and then it gets, you know, hard in certain situations, such as if a person's like maybe imposing violence or they are imposing something to your child that you strongly don't align with or, you know, things of the like.
But, yeah, I mean, in some cases, these techniques take two to tango, right? You know, with something like forgiveness, you know, forgiveness in some ways can be monodirectional. Like you can have that, you can hold that power to release that anger while still holding someone accountable, et cetera. It's not reconciliation, but it's forgiveness. But in some of these cases, you really do need to find a partner in order to make it profitable.
When do you draw? There's like, this is something that happened to me with the whole, are you allowed to say the C word, the COVID word on the internet? I don't even know. It feels so like censored and right. Tyrannical.
You have to put like a hyphen and an asterisk in it to,
yeah. It's so weird, which is indicative of so many things.
Yeah.
But that really opened, that drew up a sensation within me, because typically I lean from more of the kind of pacifist, you know, live and let live and find the middle way and, you know, whatever. And at some point, that was one of the first times in my life, at least for as far as like politics goes, where it was like, at some point, you do need to draw a line in the sand and say, if you pass this line, violence or something physical, or like there's no other option other than me actually going outside. Or I might disagree with myself on this as well, but my curiosity is like, when do you draw a line in the sand and start to go outside of like the lens of a Gandhi or a Buddha? Or do you just keep on being the Buddha in all situations, no matter how terrible the violence may be around you or the actions may be transpiring?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, Aaron, I think this is one of the most difficult quandaries to untangle as a human. Because of course, you know, you could summon all sorts of examples. You know, what if Europe and Russia and eventually the United States did not stand up to Nazi Germany and the Axis powers, right?
Yeah.
Okay. At what point, you know, is violence justified in order to achieve some sort of overarching utilitarian moral good?
Yeah. Is there a space where violence is virtuous?
Yeah. I mean, I think looking back, you know, across the annals of history, my instinct would say yes. And I think that threshold is very, very high. And that's a pretty wishy-washy answer, you know, but I think that there's a lot of gray area in that answer. Because, you know, if I looked at this conflagration right now, not to just like step flatly on the third rail, but in like Israel-Palestine, you know, yes, do I believe that Israel has the right to defend itself? Sure. Do I think they would have actually been better off and maintained a moral high ground such that the world would have really, really gotten behind them had they not gone in with such an extensive ground war in Gaza? Yes, I do believe that. And I think that they, you know, whatever, this is all Monday morning Aaron Rodgers style quarterbacking.
Yeah.
But you know, I think that there's a place where you really need tremendous thoughtfulness and in order to make these kinds of decisions, that you really need to find that Viktor Frankl space between stimulus and response. You know, and I get it. I mean, people do awful, awful things when they're not in a place of safety and security. So we know that just like day to day, right? In our own little petty lives. But imagine that at a grandiose scale. But still, this marks the biggest challenge for human evolution. You know, can we actually cultivate that space as societies, you know, in order to make more thoughtful and compassionate you know, decisions that have so much impact.
We'll take a moment and share a short word from our sponsors. Are y'all tired of feeling tired? Do you always hit snooze, then slam your head straight back on the pillow with all the problems you have to take care of at work and at home with your family, with your friends? And it's no wonder you're feeling freaking tired. You take care of a lot of different things. But if you really stop to think about it, who takes care of you? Magnesium Breakthrough is an all-natural supplement that helps you reduce fatigue and sleep more peacefully. It even strengthens muscles and improves your heart and brain function. While most magnesium supplements aren't full spectrum, Magnesium Breakthrough is the only magnesium supplement on the market that contains the optimal ratio of all 7 essential types of magnesium. Imagine having the strength and energy to get out of bed every morning and face the day boldly, courageously, to be able to show up as your best self and keep that energy up throughout the day and into the night. So if you want to feel more energized and get the best night's sleep you've had in forever, and you'd like to get a 10% discount on Bioptimizers Magnesium, jump over to bioptimizers.com/align and use promo code ALIGN10 for 10% off of your purchase. That is spelled bioptimizers.com/align and use align 10 for 10% off. They have 100% money back guarantee. If you do not notice a difference, get your money back. I think you guys will dig it. Bioptimizers.com/align10 promo code for 10% off.
How does a person at an individual level going deeper into physiological self regulation? I don't know. It's a fluffy way of saying, like, just feeling at ease, feeling good. What are some other tactics that people can lean into to be able to have clarity within themselves to not perceive the world as a threat?
Yeah. Well, it makes me think, could we all take a collective breath as a nation state, you know, the way that we breathed before we started the podcast, you know? And when I think, and I won't spend much more time on international politics, but when I think, you know, the role of government at the very, very basic level is to provide safety and security, right? But then, of course, those ideas, that state of being is very, you can lay that over kind of the individual experience so very, very easily, right? We know that when we're in a place of safety and security, we are in a parasympathetic state such that we can leverage our more advanced neo-mammalian capabilities. That's what we also have to do as countries and nation states, et cetera. Yeah. But at the very kind of personal level, I think, you know, just the awareness that there are tools at our disposal in order to pull ourselves back into that place of safety and security, you know, such that we can make quote unquote more rational decisions. But it's not just like using our reason. It's actually being more aware of our somatic states, of our relationships, of our breath, of our heart rate. I mean, I've gotten to the point now, because I was quasi-diabetic, kind of right on the edge of pre-diabetes and adult onset type 2 diabetes, where I do wear a continuous glucose monitor on my triceps, but I am so aware of my body is that I can probably tell you where my glucose levels are moment to moment, because I have cultivated sort of an awareness within my body to be able to do so. So, you know, really this is where all, behind all of the protocols is kind of this mindset, because this is where we experience life. You know, everything is a perception of consciousness. And so can you find that awareness? So there are many, many, many techniques in order to cultivate that awareness, that space between stimulus and response. Obviously, kind of meditation being kind of, you know, the highest rung of the ladder. But many other ones. I mean, I think like deliberate cold therapy is one. We could talk all day about the metabolic benefits of it, about, you know, dopamine release and all of the other kind of physiological components of it. I think it is one of the most potent psychological tools that you could ever leverage. You know, it is a stressful conversation, but it's one with yourself in an ice bath, you know? Yeah. So I think this is the great opportunity there. And this is why I think about them as good stress, because you're pushing yourself in the right dosage to the edge and then self-regulating and moving back to the middle. Yeah. We're always just moving back to the middle.
What about within creating business? What are things, what are stressors that have come up over the years, and how have you been able to manage that effectively?
Yeah. Well, I actually now look forward to things going wrong. It's a little strange. I'm not sure I'm going to, you know, lead with that on my next all team meeting. But I actually, I remember like with Wanderlust, the very, very inaugural year, the very, very first year of Wanderlust, and anyone who's even produced a retreat knows how many details and logistics, but imagine a retreat with like 5,000 people, you know, on a side of a four-walled mountain resort or whatever. It's like in stages everywhere in 150 crew or whatever. So that's where I was in 2009, first year of Wanderlust Squaw Valley. And man, the new need friends, I'll tell you that much. It's hard to get something off the ground. We had sold like 100 tickets, you know, basically nothing, you know, and I was looking at a massive financial loss and quite a lot of embarrassment, honestly. I ended up moving my family out to the festival site about 45 days before the event and just driving around with my 4 or 5 year old daughter, giving away tickets, just trying to get people there. It was an intense, hilarious experience, honestly.
This is,
probably
this is
for
2009?
Another podcast. This is 2009. Yeah. And so,
or what made you, start Wanderlust in the first place?
Oh, wow. Okay. This is a rewind. I'll try to give you it in a concise fashion.
Yeah.
So I was in the music business. I grew up as a musician. My first job out of college was in the music industry. I started a record label and a management company, and I signed my brother, Eric, who's a virtuosic guitar player. And from there, it just kind of grew. I had like 35 artists in my management portfolio and a record label and the whole thing. My office was one and a half blocks north of the World Trade Center. So 2001 comes along and 9/11 happens, and we're in that tight little radius right around the World Trade Center. We can't get into our office for a couple months. Finally, we get back. It's like the windows are blown through and it's like soot and ash everywhere. And it was a very creative building in terms of the other tenants, and they all basically flew the coop. They were out. So there was all this empty space, and you know, living in that time in New York was kind of beautiful and intense and awful, but it inspired people to do like crazy things, honestly. And one of those people was my wife, Skylar. So she's been a yoga teacher all of her life. So she was like, you know, I'm going to start a yoga studio at Ground Zero. And I'm like, you're crazy, but I got space for you. and she built out Kula Yoga Project, so that in Sanskrit means intentional community. And she got it open in like January 2002. And this place just, and this is before there was like some fancy Tony Equinox yoga thing on every corner. You know, this was a funky, funky one room tilted floor, you know, bathroom like the size of a bread box yoga studio. You had to climb up these cockeyed lime green stairs. It was funky. But this place is the best as far as yoga studios.
I find those typically the best teachers are
like, at. Yeah, soul all day, you know? Yeah. And yeah, it just became the epicenter for these like super beleaguered, aggrieved denizens of Lower Manhattan, that would just flow up the stairs and practice and sweat and walk out into this like little vestibule, and there was like a stained futon on the floor basically, and they just gather around, and I was sitting there all the time, you know, and I got a front row seat to watching yoga and sweat and community, the power of those things to heal and transform people's lives. So I was very moved by it, and it really bent, you know, the arc of my professional life. And my wife started leading retreats in Costa Rica, and I would, you know, bump along in the name of yoga and a lot of puddle jumpers and the back of pickup trucks and things like that. And, you know, we would go out to the Osa Peninsula, and it would be like, you know, 27 millennial women, two gay guys and me, basically like waking up with the sun, you know, meditating, surfing, although I'm not a surfer, but, you know, doing yoga, playing music, telling stories, but not like in a like sanctimonious way. People would have like a glass of wine or tequila at night, and, you know, there'd be like people hooking up in the bushes, and it was like titillating enough to make it like fun. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, you know, these are people living in their highest vibe. And then I had very sort of masculine inspiration in the rainforest of Costa Rica. It's like, what if you could scale this idea? Right. And of course, I had spent most of my music life backstage at Lollapalooza and Bonnaroo and Austin City Limits. And like, those were my friends who started a lot of those big festivals. So I was like, oh, what if, is there a chocolate and peanut butter situation here where I could take, you know, the yoga conference like out of the fluorescent lit soggy carpet hotel room and put it and breathe life into it and put it on the side of a mountain and build stages and put these teachers that I loved, you know, and give them on big stages with proper production and music and DJs and like, you know, do that whole thing. And so that was the inspiration. And then to actually execute it was, took me a few years to kind of, to, you know, make it actually happen. But to finish out the story, the day, so Michael Franti, who, I don't know if you know Michael Franti, but yeah, Spearhead.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, we got to get them to headline our first ever festival. They'll blow it out of the water. You know, Michael's a yogi. You know, he travels in airports without shoes. You know, he's the perfect guy.
I've played beach volleyball with Michael Franti in Bend, Oregon. He would always come to do shows in Bend. And that was like one of his stopping points. There was a beach volleyball court beside there. That was, at the time, it was like a big deal for playing volleyball. Yeah. Michael Franti is a good time.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, he was always cool like that. You know, he'd play pickup basketball, I guess, volleyball too.
He's like an actual dude.
Yeah, so the day... So like I said, we were having a hard time selling tickets, et cetera. So the day before his headline show, Saturday night, his agent, Jesse Aretow, who passed away, unfortunately, but called me and said, Kraz, everyone knew me as Kraz at that juncture. Kraz, if you're not sitting down, you probably should. I'm like, no, man, don't tell me. He's like, Michael burst his appendix. He's in the hospital. Fuck. He's not coming. And I'm like, oh my God, dude. I'm like, but so, you know, so this was stressful, right? You know, but how were we going to react or respond, I should say, in that moment? We were just going to like go into, you know, freeze or flight or fly. No, that wasn't an option. It's like the show had to go on. So I hung up that call. I regulated my nervous system. And over the next 2 hours, called every manager and agent and musician I knew in a very systematic way. And God bless him. Common and his whole crew flew from Brooklyn, where they were recording a record, flew into Reno that night. Oh, came to the festival the next day, filled Franti's spot.
That's amazing.
And it was a huge success.
I think Common's even a better fit in some ways. I mean, Franti's more like peace and love and yoga, but Common's like...
Yeah, he's cool. I run into him every 5 years or so, and he's always like, the Wanderlust dude, I remember you. That's I would be eternally indebted to him for doing it.
Does cool very well.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, like as a symbol of cool, I feel like Common matches that very well.
Yeah. I think he should change his name to Uncommon, because He is an uncommon guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, like these are the stressful situations. I mean, listen, no one was going to die, you know, if Michael Franti didn't play and we couldn't find a, you know, proper replacement. But I think, you know, as it pertains to like business, like we regulated, we moved into action, we made some great decisions, it worked. And that was really amazing modeling for within the company, because again, we were like weeble wobbles. You couldn't knock us over. You know, stressful things would come along, obstacles, challenges, but you could always, you know, breathe, go into that parasympathetic place, and then move from there.
How much did you invest in the first year? And you were actually at a point where you only sold 100 tickets?
Yeah. So we ended up selling a little bit more, you know, in the last couple days, you know. There were people walked up, but candidly, I think I gave away 2,000 tickets that first year. Yeah. So enough people came and experienced it and saw it and went home and told their friends about how great it was. And then the next year we crushed it and we were kind of off to the races for a while. So that was cool.
How does a person get something off the ground if they have a big idea, if they have a big wanderlust kind of idea? Because it's the 0 to 1 principle seems like the hardest situation. It seems like that's the Rubik's Cube to sort out.
Right. Well, part of it is just like any other endeavor, is making your dream somebody else's. So socializing your dream and your vision. Hmm. So, and a lot of that is being able to be really fluent about your vision and then spread it and make it other people's vision. Hmm. And so that's what we had to do on every level. Like we had to make it the teacher's vision. We had to make it the investor's vision. We had to make it the people that came, the participants' vision of like, I'm going to come and be part of this incredible, you know, positive community experience, this like festival where I come and actually leave feeling better. And that was a totally new idea. Mm. You could go to Bonnaroo or Lollapalooza, it's fun as hell, and you left feeling like shit. Yeah, yeah. You have to take like 2 days off work, right?
Yeah.
You know, you come to Wanderlust and man, people were lit up. And they went home with that spark. So, yeah, you know, part of it is really, I mean, you could call that like quote unquote selling the dream. That sounds a little glib. But, you know, for us, it was just a reflection of the soul, of the heart. Mm. But then, you know, there's a lot of like just plain old logistics and you know, business to it. You know, you got to make a financial plan and a business plan and, you know, really try to surround yourself with people that know more than you do. And
how could a person develop a business for themselves that is inherently self-regulating for their own nervous system and also simultaneously probably for the business in and of itself? I think that's kind of what you have with Commune right now. Is that right?
Totally. So this took me a long time to get there. I mean, like I said, you know, with Wanderlust, sometimes I say it was like my adventure in health and wellness that actually became wealth and hellness. Yeah. Because I was under a tremendous amount of pressure. I was working 7 days a week, 16 hours a day. I was flying on airplanes all the time. I developed like incredible, wicked insomnia. And, you know, all of these things across 10 years led to the progressive onset of diabetes, really, of type 2 diabetes. And so that was definitely the wrong way to do it. Or, you know, it was, I wouldn't say wrong. It was the learning way. The learning way, yeah. It was only wrong, I suppose, if I hadn't learned from it.
Yeah.
You know, in starting Commune, and I technically am the CEO, so it's not that I don't make any decisions, But I will go through days at a time where I almost like don't get any emails from my own team. It feels sometimes a little strange, but my whole goal here was to make myself dispensable and not indispensable. And what it's allowed me to do is it's created all of this additional airspace such that most of my life is like talking to brilliant people like you. That's like what I get to do. Yeah. And like read your books and listen to your podcasts and, you know, other people within our sphere. Yeah. And it's been an incredible use for the company because obviously I've developed this kind of network of relationships that benefits the company, but it's also been an unparalleled and inestimable opportunity for me because every day is an opportunity for to fulfill this need, this curiosity, and to grow. And so that's what I would say is like work to make yourself dispensable and not right. indispensable. And that will really, you know, serve you well. Obviously, you know, there are moments where I have to make a big decision, but at least I can do that without such a crowded brain.
Hmm. How would that apply to someone with like a smaller business or someone like, say they are a yoga teacher or they're a personal trainer or they're an acupuncturist or something of the sort? Do you think there, or maybe there's certain professions where that just doesn't apply, but like, I think that, that this still comes back to a physiological well-being conversation yeah. because your monetary health and your sensation of purpose and drive and like joie de vivre, you know, reason to wake up in the morning, all of that I think is core to one's yeah. biological well-being. But would the principles that you've garnered along the way to create commune and kind of transition from Wanderlust and, you know, the previous career path, could that also relate to someone that is, you know, like an independent contractor type person doing something like training or body work?
Yeah. Well, I think being a sole proprietor, being essentially your own business, you know, is full of pros and cons, obviously. Yeah. You're very independent and that's a big pro. I think, you know, the con to the degree that there is one is that, you know, you're the only person in the room. Yeah. So, you know, you don't have that thrill of collective enterprise or of collaboration that you might within a team.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, it's trying to find that opportunity for partnership. I've never actually done anything that's just me. But that being said, I think a lot of it is like how you establish your own self-worth. So, and you know, this honestly speaks to something kind of more spiritual. Now, before we get there, obviously, you need to fulfill your safety and security. So you need to make enough money, right, in order to not be financially stressed such that that spills over into your physiological and psychological health.
Yeah, it's huge.
Sure. So hard to give anyone any prescription there just because everyone's doing something different. But if you're yep. going to be a sole proprietor, you're going to have to spend time doing your business and embrace that. You know, you're... And know that that's part of the equation. I think the other side of it, though, is that we so often get invested in a false sense of success, you know, such that we are judging ourselves through the eyes of others and kind of get into this kind of game of hedonic comparison, right? Yeah. So, and... You know, I've tried to find sort of a tight way of thinking about success in those terms of like, yeah, of course, like I want you, Aaron, to respect me. Like that's important to me, you know? I'm not going to say that that's like totally unimportant and I should only judge myself through my own eyes, you know, whatever. But to have sort of a healthy idea or notion of success is to really be respected by those who you respect and not really worry about international Kardashian level fame. Right. You know, that'll come or it won't. But, you know, for me, it's so much more important that folks like you and, you know, Mark Hyman and Sarah Gottfried and my other kind of close friends, honestly, you know, that there is a mutual respect. And I think that that's a much healthier, you know, way of pursuing self-worth outside of just, you know, building your own core sense of self-love and self-esteem.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that's something I've heard. I don't know who I was listening to recently, but there it was essentially like anybody can say whatever they want, because literally the only people's opinions that I value is my family and my close friends. Mm-hmm. And if you can actually hold that and sit in that, it's like, yeah, the whole like parasocial internet relationship, the whole entire planet having an opinion, and you have no idea their psychological health or whatever kind of like mental pathologies they're dealing with, or like who or what, or even if it could be a Russian bot talking shit on you. Totally. And it's derailing you from right. your sense of purpose in that day, or just feeling, you know, at ease in that day.
Yeah. And so it defining, goes back to that euthymia quality, you know, that we were poking at that earlier, you know, build that psychological immune system. And, you know, one's spiritual life, you know, this commitment to kind of rigorous self-examination, I think in the end is really what we should be most committed to, because it really yields, I think, what we're truly craving, which is a sensation, like this mystical sensation that we sometimes get in experiences of meditation or plant medicine, et cetera, that we are truly part of some sort of mutual interdependent web, that we're not just like this individual locus of consciousness, like stuck in a ever diminishing bag of skin, you know?
Yeah, it's very lonely.
And that kind of by inhabiting that state of being, we get to experience its signatures, you know, compassion and loving kindness and empathetic joy. You know, that's true wealth, you know, really. And, you know, I'm a big Alan Watts fan. You know, Alan Watts was always like, you know, we always, you know, confuse the map with the territory.
Sure.
You know, we confuse the menu with the actual food.
The actual meal.
We confuse like the symbol of something with the thing itself, and I think that infects how most of us, or many of us, think about wealth. You know, like what truly makes you wealthy, and it's clearly not logging into E-Trade and checking out your daily balance, although. I admit that I am guilty of that from time to time.
Well, you want enough to feel safe.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then that's obviously different for each person. And then probably an even more powerful position to be in is to feel safe with less and less and less and less and less. And then build whatever you want on top of that, I would think.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think we all experience that from time to time where, you know, you'll have a moment of true ease and you examine it and you say to yourself, wow, I really don't need that much.
Yeah.
And it's funny because in the absence of need, love becomes something more given than taken. You know, so it's like, I don't need you to fulfill the requirements of my ego or the requirements of my bank account. You begin to fulfill your own needs, such that, you know, love really can be something given. And, you know, I think for me, I experienced that in the most stark relief with my daughters. I have three daughters. So it's very easy for me just to give love to them and not really require anything. Because, you know, I think there's a built-in engineering there for that phenomenon. But I think, you know, my goal is to try to extend that, you know, outside of my horrible, adorable X chromosomes in my family.
Well, I appreciate you putting yourself through all the stress and bullshit to arrive yourself in diabetes and recovery and coming to a place to be able to teach tools on regulation and building more integrated relationships and business and things of the like. I feel like you're like, I really enjoy learning from you. I really appreciate you offering the things that you've learned to people in a digestible way. So we have the, I'm actually looking at the good stress. What do we have? We got a program. There's a book coming up. Book's not coming up until next year. There's a TV series coming up. You have all sorts of stuff happening. What's a good, if people want to keep on going deeper into your world, what's a good direction to point people?
Yeah, I think the thing closest on the horizon is this 10-day program called Good Stress, which you can register for free. That launches in April. And you can just go to onecommune.com/goodstress. So that's onecommune.com/goodstress. Cool. And, you know, it's all the self-imposed deliberate stress protocols. You know, I spent a good amount of time as a very dedicated intermittent faster and, you know, cold water therapy, heat therapy, light therapy, resistance training, which is something I never did my entire life. And, you know, I found a way to stack these protocols in a way that completely turned around my health. I mean, I was not in a good shape, Aaron, both physically and mentally. Mm. And then, you know, in this course, I also try to apply these principles of physiological adversity mimetics to psychology and social well-being, et cetera. So there's a whole section on social fitness, essentially like the things that we actually have to force ourselves to do in this day and age, to actually, you know, build the social connections, you know, that we require. And sometimes actually, strangely enough, to be socially connected, you have to impose some solitude on yourself. Sure. Such that you're connected to yourself. So these are a lot of the techniques that I picked up. There's a section in there all about stressed plants. So xenohormetans, which I think are a fascinating concept. I love the kind of interrelationship between humans and the natural world. So, you know, plants also get stressed and they also have a hormetic response such that, you know, they build within their, they build their own resilience. We call the chemicals, the phytonutrients of resilience in plants, we call them polyphenols, you know, quercetin and luteolin and, you know, some of these words that people might be familiar with. And, you know, this, the benefits that plants have built in relationship with stress, those benefits are then transferred to humans when we consume them. Hmm. So I have a whole list of, you know, the world's most stressed plants. So it's cool. It's a lot of fun.
Say the URL one more time.
So it's one commune, that's onecommune.com and /or/ good stress. Oh. And, I also have goodstress.com if you want to. Right now, that's just a little window into the TV show, which will is another beast. But hopefully, we can talk about that at some point.
Amazing, man. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. All right. Thank you all for tuning in. That's it. That's all. See you next week. You guys enjoyed that conversation. If you did, jump over to the Align Podcast YouTube channel, labeled aptly Align Podcast. Subscribe over there if you want to see the video version of these episodes as well as instructional content. Thank you for subscribing wherever you're listening to this. Thank you for doing you, and I'll see you next week.